Well, good day. You are listening to www.spirituality.org.za, another podcast, and my name is Dion Foster, and we thank you for downloading this. I'm here with Paul Oosthuizen again. Hi, Paul.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us, and Paul is a Methodist minister here in South Africa at John Wesley College. And Paul is particularly well known in his ministry for working on issues of social justice, and has been a member of one of the real exemplary churches in our area. You've certainly heard me refer to it numerous times on the blog, Calvary Methodist Church. And if you want to find out more about Calvary, you can go to www.calvary.org.za and read a little bit more about that church. Now, Paul, it's good to have you with us, and thanks for the time. Paul and I are wanting to talk today particularly about some events that transpired here in South Africa last night, 30th of January and 31st of January 2008, and we're particularly wanting to talk about the police's raid on the Central Methodist Mission, a Methodist church in the center of Johannesburg that houses refugees. Now, before we get onto that specific topic, Paul, I know that Calvary is has a very strong ministry in working with refugees from Zimbabwe and elsewhere in Africa. Tell us a little bit about this crisis. Why is there such a problem with our neighboring states, and why are people coming to South Africa in such numbers?
I think particularly we need to bear in mind that in some senses, I think many people are aware of the flow of refugees, particularly economic and social refugees, to the States for similar reasons, seeking a better life, seeking economic prosperity, and also seeking safety from political persecution of various forms. And particularly at Calvary, we found the similar problems, particularly with the situation in Zimbabwe. We had people fleeing for economic reasons, simply finding that they cannot live due to the status of the currency, of the way the economy is running, and seeking to find better work in South Africa. But also those who had experienced violent oppression, people who had been beaten up, youths who had been forced into joining militias, that kind of thing. And so now we began to find increasing numbers of Zimbabwean, particularly refugees, on the streets, who would arrive and sometimes lose touch with the person they had contacted, and ended up often destitute, losing their goods that they'd brought with them for various reasons, theft, attacks. And we ended up just trying to find shelter for them, trying to find work for them, trying to find many of them very skilled, teachers, doctors, engineers, plumbers, with great skills, and simply unable to find a way forward in a country that needs those skills and can offer refuge. And that we often sought refuge in those countries during the dark days of apartheid.
Yeah.
So really,
you know, I want to pick up on that point for a few minutes, Paul. I mean, one of the great sadnesses that we've heard many people talk about, but particularly Bishop Verrain, who is the minister at Central Methodist Church, in the media, has spoken about the South African government's inadequate response to the problems that are faced in Zimbabwe in particular. Many of the listeners would know from following the news that South Africa has adopted a policy of quiet diplomacy. It's been interesting for me to, I don't know if you've read Andrew Feinstein's book, After the Party, An Inside History of the ANC. It's been interesting to read his comments on why it is that the president's office is so disempowered in dealing with Robert Mugabe. Yeah. But what is your perspective on that? I mean, why haven't they been stronger?
I think we have to bear in mind that there has been tremendous support for the ANC from neighboring states. They were an incredible place of refuge, strength, training, and equipping people during apartheid, and certainly a place that people were welcomed. Sadly, I think that welcome and that friendship has continued on higher levels. But the sadness is that we've forgotten that it was the poor, the marginalized, who pay the salaries of those who assisted us in the dark days. And now when a government has turned against its own people, we are still friends with the government, but have forgotten our friendship with the people.
Yeah.
And I think that's some of the struggle that I think is faced there. And I also think there's really a struggle to just own the reality of a country that somehow a leadership has gone astray.
Yeah.
And we really struggle sometimes to point out the failures when so much of the world is always pointing out failures within Africa.
Yeah.
I think there's a sensitivity to that.
Feinstein comments in his book very interestingly. He says, you know, that that there was some measure of discord or dis-ease between the Thabo Mbeki regime and the Nelson Mandela regime. And we know that Nelson Mandela was quite outspoken against the Robert Mugabe ZANU-PF government in Zimbabwe. And so it wasn't befriended or welcomed as warmly by Robert Mugabe. And, of course, Robert Mugabe wasn't as warmly welcomed by Nelson Mandela. Yeah. And so Feinstein suggests that one of the reasons why Thabo Mbeki has been so open and accepting and affirming and quiet about the abuses has been to garner support of African leaders for the African Renaissance.
Mm. And we always have to remember that politics is a political game. And I think some of the sadness is the ANC has a heritage of incredible values that they've stood for and remarkable. And, I mean, I really have enjoyed that. It's just wonderful to see how countries that have been their friends, they have continued to be friends with, even despite the world condemning it. But yet, sometimes as friends, we need to stand up and say, friend, what you're doing here... I struggle to honor it, and I struggle to celebrate it. Mm. And I think that's the mark of good friendship. And one kind of hopes that at some point our government will say, you are our friends, but as friends, we say to you that something needs to change.
Yeah. Now, the big problem, Paul, that where this really impacts, I think, particularly refugees, is that because our government has not been willing to be strong about its opposition to the real struggles, and I mean, you know, just real economic collapse in Zimbabwe. I mean, you can go into shops and not find a single thing on a supermarket shelf. No petrol, no milk, no flour.
No water.
No water, yeah. I mean, we have, I have a good friend who obviously one doesn't want to name in an open forum, who goes once a month with a trailer load of hidden foodstuffs, you know. And simple things like pencils and rulers and tissues and hand cream and powdered milks that he takes to ministers and their families in Zimbabwe who want to stay there to do work but literally can't afford black market prices and are not surviving. Now, when one thinks about it in that way, I mean, if you're a parent and your child can't get medication, you don't have petrol to drive anywhere, I would think about going south to a place where things are easier. The problem is, however, because our government hasn't been as strong on recognizing that these people are actually bona fide refugees, they find themselves as illegal aliens in our country. Now, what is the impact of that, if you know, legally upon a person? What are some of the problems?
The sad truth of our country is that many things change, but many things stay the same. Under the old apartheid system, all persons of color had to carry a pass in order to ensure that they could not be arrested and sent to work camps if they were in areas illegally. In some sense, that is not true of our citizens, but sadly, anyone caught without the legal documentation, which is compulsory to carry, it's a green ID book. And if you're caught without a permanent residence visa, which is included in that ID book, or without an ID book, you're automatically arrested. And normally that arrest is conducted in a way which is often unethical. For between 200 and 400 rands, you can buy your way out of prison in the first night. But if you aren't able to do that, you get sent to a deportation camp called Lindela, particularly overcrowded, very difficult to get in contact with family and friends, very difficult to gain access to. And you're kept there for sometimes weeks, sometimes months at a time. And you can, again, buy your way out. The going rate when I was last in contact with refugees was 800 rand. And otherwise, after a while, you'll be deported back to the country of your origin. To get refugee status is almost impossible, particularly with Zimbabwe. The government's reluctance to admit the faults of Zimbabwe means that they are reluctant to admit that you could be a refugee. Because to say that you're a refugee is to say that you're seeking refuge from oppression. And the government seems unwilling at this stage to own that.
I'd heard a statistic recently, and I can't verify it, but I'd heard that that only something like 758 people had been granted refugee status in the Gauteng region, and there are more than 2 million refugees. Now, I don't know, I can't even, I'm not a mathematician, so I can't even calculate what 0.000% that is. But I mean, that's absolutely shocking.
I was in the border region about a year ago, and I spoke with some of the police officers there. And they were speaking of arresting between 700 and 1,500 refugees a day seeking to cross. And they estimated that they were only catching between 5 and 10% of the actual amount of refugees crossing. And the amazing thing is, meeting some of the refugees, they have walked for kilometers and kilometers, hundreds of kilometers, from rural areas. They have been exploited in cross-border crossings, similar to what happens in many other places in North Africa and Mexico. Exploited in terrible ways, suffered incredible deprivation, seeking a better life.
Mm.
And we really need to remember that this is a God-given world. There are no borders drawn by God. All people are God's people. And so it's particularly trying to understand what's happening in the light of the concept of Jesus as a refugee, the concept of the people of Egypt as refugees, the people of Israel as refugees in Egypt.
Mm.
And the oppression, and one of the key aspects of our history as people of faith is a story of a people being set free from oppression and finding a home in a new place.
Now let's move on to talking a little bit about that, Paul, particularly when one considers the gospel and the manifesto of Jesus that we read in Luke chapter 4. Where Jesus speaks about coming to set free the captives and liberate the oppressed and restore the sight of the blind. What kind of things do you think that God would want the churches to be doing in South Africa?
I think when I study the scriptures, I am so taken aback by the incredible power of hospitality. It's one of the fundamental values of scripture. To be a people of hospitality amongst people of Jewish faith, it is a key value that we hold as people of faith, to receive people with welcome and in many ways to receive people as Christ. And thus, when we come to looking at the refugee system, as churches we have to ask the question, how do we welcome people from other places? How do we receive the stranger in our midst? How do we welcome the sojourner who comes to be with us? And I think the struggle for people in South Africa is that we have, in some ways, the value of xenophobia stands out, and we have not been particularly welcoming. And so I think the real challenge is to stand as the church and say, we will welcome those others refuse to welcome.
Mm.
We will include those that others exclude. We will feed those who have nothing. We will clothe those who have nothing to be clothed with. And we will also befriend.
Mm.
And I think really, in some ways, we really need to take up that challenge and receive it as a challenge as the Church of Southern Africa, and really owning that word, the Church of Southern Africa, not the Church of South Africa, and saying, how can we be a light in the midst of struggle?
Mm. You know, one of the things that I often hear from ministers and congregation members when one says we need to feed and welcome and clothe and facilitate and create jobs and these kinds of things is that they say, well, there's not even enough for us. I mean, we live in an economic reality within South Africa. And just to say to those who are elsewhere in the world, Southern Africa and South Africa are two different things. Southern Africa refers to the geographical region in the south of the African continent, and South Africa is an independent nation state. But in South Africa, we have huge economic discrepancies and issues that we're needing to address. And very often people say, well, you know, if we're welcoming people from elsewhere, it's taking the little that we have. Do you know, the fundamental problem with that from a faith perspective is that it's basing our response on a scarcity mentality.
Yes,
and we need to remember that we serve a God who is generous.
And I think we can own the fact that we live in a country and a region that has incredible resources. We are not a country of scarcity. There is enough for all. But it's merely, again, the point of distribution, which is a worldwide problem that we see all over the world. Globalization has exposed the underbelly of that in many ways. But South Africa, in some sense, is a microcosm of that disparity between haves and have-nots. And so many churches that speak of, I find, that speak of saying there's not enough, one almost wants to say, can I check your bank account?
Mm.
And really ask that question in a meaningful way and say, what is enough for you? And I remember a friend who always says, how can we live simply so that others can simply live?
Mm.
And I'm challenged by that statement when people say there's not enough. I have to ask myself, am I living in a way that's simple so that others can simply live?
Mm.
And I think that is the challenge of the church, to be a prophetic church that that asks our congregations, that asks people of faith, how can you live simply so that others can simply live?
Mm.
And we then trust the abundance of God, that in a moment where there's insufficient bread and fish will be broken and will be blessed and will be distributed, and there will be enough that there will even be over.
Mm. Paul, now let's move specifically to the events that took place last night. Those who follow South African news would have heard it was the first story on the news today that the police, around about midnight last night, went into the Central Methodist Mission, which is the large church in the center of Johannesburg's inner city, and conducted a raid there, arresting hundreds of illegal refugees, as they were termed, although I doubt that very many of them had refugee status. Tell us a little bit about your knowledge. I know we've both been involved at various stages in Central Methodist Mission and what's going on there. Tell us a little bit about what happens there, and particularly what you know of the most current situation before we get to the raid.
I've visited Central Methodist Church many times over the last 5 or 6 years and come to know Bishop Paul Verain in that time. And there came a moment where Central Methodists just began to notice the increasing amount of people living on the streets, refugees seeking somehow a better life and finding really marginalization.
And we need to mention, I mean, these are not just, you know, strapping young men. These are pregnant women, babies. I mean, it's
a complete variety.
Whole families of people living on the streets.
And so there came a moment where wrestling with the gospel imperative to welcome, to receive, to provide hospitality, and wrestling also with the fact that they had this 3-4-story building standing in the center of this struggle, standing in the center of these streets that are overwhelmed with people seeking refuge. Why would we lock the doors at night and leave the church empty while others sleep on the streets in situations that are perilous? Johannesburg in winter is extremely cold, below 0 degrees, negative temperatures, and really, really a place of danger. People can die from the elements. And also unsafe, a place of where people can be accosted on the street, where there would be vigilante groups at times accosting people. And so they began to open the doors. And a difficult process of saying, how can we do this? I remember walking in the first time and just being struck by hundreds of people, literally cramped, trying to find a space on the floor to live, trying to figure out how do we provide adequate sanitation, how do we provide adequate cooking facilities, how do we manage conflict that happened in the community, and really seeking to do them in the way that's gospel-orientated, and also trying to wrestle with these issues with the congregation.
Mm.
The congregation finding at times entering what they would say is their church, and wrestling with what does it mean when their church has suddenly been overwhelmed with people in need. And then discovering, well, maybe it's not our church, maybe it's God's church.
Mm.
And really struck by that. And the radical message that it sent out to the surrounding community, it really, for me, has become almost a prophetic community of saying, we are doing this on behalf of Jesus. What are you doing?
Yeah. You know, it's been interesting to note. I mean, I think most churches would struggle with what they perceive to be their space, you know, and all of the stories that I've seen in the news in recent years have not been stories that have praised the church for welcoming the stranger.
Not at all.
They've all been stories that have said, you know, overcrowding is taking place in an inner city church. There's not adequate sanitation. That the people have been caught. I remember the particularly bold headline about, you know, people having sex in church. Well, I mean, these are married people. This is the place where they live, you know. Yeah, and it really is a difficult thing. I mean, one really needs to ask how much money was spent building that structure, and should it really just be used for 1 hour or 2 hours on a Sunday? Does that honor God? I mean, that's an important question. You know, the other thing which I found remarkable about the way in which the community is structured, the refugee community is structured, is that they are a community who Paul has organized. I mean, they have a committee that's elected. People are welcome to come, but they do need to be in worship. They need to adhere to a code of conduct. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there'll always be problems with that.
Mm-hmm.
At last count I heard there were between 700 and 1,000 people, men, women and children. Mm-hmm. And there was obviously a desire to put, you know, women and children in the chapel, mm-hmm. and men in the sanctuary, and so a desire to try and do that. Yeah.
And I think also for many times when issues arise, I think that the fundamental thing we need to remember is what is our stance in that moment? Do we recognize that there are code of conducts and that sometimes people in their humanity break those? And that's part of being a community. Mm. Do we begin to ask the question, well, if there's overcrowding there, how do our own places of worship look? Are they overcrowded? Are they desperately needing? There are some churches that struggle even to fill a congregation on a Sunday, never to mind to fill the church throughout the week. So really, we have to wrestle with what is this overcrowding say to us as a community. And so while people may condemn the overcrowding, we almost need to say, what does it condemn within ourselves?
Mm.
And where does it take us as people of faith? What questions does it ask us?
You know, and Paul, I think particularly for people of our generation, we're beginning to come to the point where we say a church that does not address social issues cannot be a community of true faith.
Absolutely.
Because the core of the gospel is good news.
Yeah.
It is about liberation and healing and wholeness and justice and mercy. I mean, that's what God brings to us. You know, I often say to our students, for example, that salvation in our context is more than just confessing Jesus Christ as Lord and forgiving, receiving forgiveness for your sins. You know, when you're a single mother whose husband has died of HIV/AIDS and you have three hungry children, salvation means something different.
Yep.
It means putting food in their mouths and a roof over their heads. That's what you long for, and that's what I believe God longs for as well. So there's a real challenge, I think, for us in our churches, you know, to say, how are we using our facilities? You know, are they being adequately used for the kingdom of God? Or are we stuck in this traditional mold that worshiping God is what we do and we sing songs on a Sunday? So I can tell you, when those doors are opened and 700 people find shelter, God is worshipped.
And I also think we need to ask the question, I've heard many people say, what is the line between the sacred and the profane? And many people have said that if people living in a church, somehow it denies the sacredness of that venue.
Mm, denigrates it.
Absolutely. And in some way, asking, in some way, is it not making that place sacred? Is a place not sacred when it becomes an embodiment of Christ, of Christ's desires and wishes and hopes and dreams for the world? Is that what makes a place sacred? Or is it simply that we gather to speak and tell of things, or do we gather to enact what we are speaking about?
Yeah. Now, Paul, just to move on to what happened last night, I've tried to find a few facts this morning just to see what happened. And I know that there have been various meetings between Bishop Verein and authorities in the city, and that there is general knowledge that there are illegal immigrants, persons living there. But I wonder, I mean, I don't know how you feel about this, but I had to really say, Lord, just guard me this morning, because to hear that the police come rushing in after midnight and the doors are broken down. And, you know, I mean, I've been there at night to see, you know, mothers with their little children. I can just imagine the kind of chaos that erupted. As people were afraid that they would be arrested, and you know, I wonder how many people were injured, and whether the police actually thought about the safety of those who were in there. And you know, the thing that I sort of mentioned to you just before we started recording was to say, you know, I really think that our government shames itself when it will deal with things in this way, rather than dealing with the cause of the problem.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think we don't have the political will to do that, you know, and that's the problem.
And also, I think the truth is that there has been engagement with the authorities. I don't get the sense that that community has sought to do anything in secret. There has been an open and honest conversation with the reality they are experiencing and seeking to engage the government and seeking to say, government, come and play with us. Come and play the game of seeking to bring liberation, because that is what your organization stands for. Mm. And come and asking those questions. And so it's almost, in some sense, a betrayal of that relationship. When you do not, instead of having a conversation with those involved, the committee involved in Central, to come in at midnight And to do it in a way which breaks things down, which destroys, which brings fear and chaos, when there could have been alternatives. And there have been an opportunity to investigate alternatives. One is saddened when a government resorts to violence as the first option, resorts to prosecution, incarceration as the first option. Really, we believe in a principle of restorative justice. We have seen the TRC seeking reconciliation with truth. And so, in some sense, what happened last night, early this morning, is a betrayal of those values.
Yeah.
And that's the deep sadness
yeah.
of just a betrayal.
Yeah. Well, Paul, I think we've offered a couple of insights there, and I know I've certainly learnt from you this morning, and we hope, listeners, that there are one or two things that will inform your prayer life. And we do encourage you, keep an eye on this space. We are trying to find some ways to express our solidarity and care, particularly with Bishop Paul Verrain, who is in the centre of this and hasn't been well in the last little while. And so we do encourage you, please, you know, if you have groups of people, particularly those of you who know us well at Duke Divinity School and those in at Wesley House in Cambridge who contact us often, call together a few people for prayer. Let us remember, let's not be silent about these things. Let's bring the darkness into the light so that it can be exposed. Well, Paul, thanks for being with me today. Thanks for your time and for your insights, and may the Lord bless you. And thank you for listening to this podcast. You've been listening to Paul Oosthuizen and Dion Foster, and this is a download from www.spirituality.org.za. Goodbye.